you whisked grandchildren away from me. I laugh under my breath. My mother is the most dramatic person I know. She hardly wanted to be a mother when Ava and I were little, and I know for a fact she's in no hurry to be a grandmother. That's one aspect of her personality I'm able to find relief in. She doesn't nag me about having a baby. She only prays I never adopt. Ava brought up adoption at one of our lunches with my mother 2 years ago. My mother actually scoffed at the idea. "Quinn, please tell me you aren't pondering the idea of raising someone else's child," she said. "It could have issues." Ava just looked at me and rolled her eyes, then texted me under the table. "Yes, because biological children never have issues. Your mother needs to take a look in the mirror." I'm going to miss her so much. "I already miss you so much," I text her. "Still here." "Honestly, girls, do neither of you know table etiquette by now?" I look up and my mother is glaring at our phones. I lock mine and shove it in my purse. "How is Graham?" my mother asks. She only asks out of courtesy. Even though Graham and I have been married for over 7 years, she still wishes he were anyone else. He's never been good enough for me in her eyes, but not because she wants the best for me. If it were up to my mother, Graham would be Ethan, and I'd be living in a house as big as hers, and she'd be able to brag to all her friends about how much richer her daughter is than Evelyn Bradbury. "He's great," I say without elaborating, because honestly, I'm only assuming Graham is great. I can't tell anymore what he's feeling or thinking, or if he's great or good or miserable. Really great.
"Are you feeling okay?"
"I feel fine. Why?"
"I don't know," she says, giving me the once-over. "You just look tired. Are you getting enough sleep?"
"Wow," Ava mutters. I roll my eyes and pick up my menu. My mother has always had a knack for direct insults. It never bothers me much because she jabs both Ava and me an even amount. Probably because we look so much alike. Ava is only 2 years older than me. We both have the same straight brown hair that reaches just past our shoulders. We have the same eyes that are identical in color to our hair. And according to our mother, we both look tired a lot. We order our food and make small talk until it arrives. Lunch is almost in the bag when someone approaches our table.
"Avril?"
Ava and I both look up as Eleanor Watts adjusts her baby blue Hermes bag from one shoulder to the other. She tries to make it appear subtle, but she might as well hit us over the head with it while screaming, "Look at me, I can afford a $15,000 purse."
"Eleanor," my mother exclaims.
She stands and they air kiss, and I force a smile when Eleanor looks at us.
"Quinn and Ava!
Ladies, you are as beautiful as ever." I have half a mind to ask her if I look tired. She takes an empty seat and cradles her arms around her bag.
"How are you, Avril? I haven't seen you since..."
She pauses.
"Quinn's engagement party to Ethan Van Kemp," my mother finishes.
Eleanor shakes her head.
"I can't believe it's been that long. Look at us. We're grandparents now.
How did that even happen?" My mother picks up her martini glass and sips from it.
"I'm not a grandmother yet," she says, almost as if she's bragging about it. "Ava is moving to Europe with her husband. Children interfere with their wanderlust," she says, waving her hand flippantly toward Ava.
Eleanor turns to me, her eyes scanning my wedding ring before they move back to my face.
"And what about you, Quinn? You've been married a while now."
She says this with ignorant laughter. My cheeks burn, even though I should be used to this conversation by now. I know people don't mean to be insensitive, but the intention doesn't make the comments hurt any less.
"When are you and Graham going to have a baby?"
"Do you not want children?"
"Keep trying, it'll happen." I clear my throat and pick up my glass of water.
"We're working on it," I say, right before taking a sip.
I want that to be the end of it, but my mother ensures it isn't. She leans in toward Eleanor like I'm not even here.
Quinn is struggling with infertility, my mother says, as if it's anyone's business other than mine and Graham's. Eleanor tilts her head and looks at me with pity. Oh, honey, she says, placing her hand over mine. I'm so sorry to hear that. Have the two of you considered IVF? My niece and her husband couldn't conceive naturally, but they're expecting twins any day now. Have we considered IVF? Is she serious right now? I should probably just smile and tell her that's a great idea, but I'm suddenly aware that I have a limit, and it was just reached. Yes, Eleanor, I say, pulling my hand from hers. We've been through 3 unsuccessful rounds, actually. It drained our savings account, and we had to take out a second mortgage on our home. Eleanor's face reddens, and I'm immediately embarrassed by my reply, which means my mother is probably mortified. I don't look at her to validate my assumption, though. I can see Ava taking a swig of her water, trying to hide her laughter. Oh, Eleanor says, that's... I'm sorry. Don't be, my mother interjects. There's a reason for everything we go through, right? Even the struggles. Eleanor nods. Oh, I believe that wholeheartedly, she says. God works in mysterious ways. I laugh quietly. Her comment is reminiscent of the many comments my mother has said to me in the past. I know she doesn't mean to be, but Avril Donnelly is the most insensitive of anyone. Graham and I decided to start trying for a baby after only 1 year into our marriage. I was so naive, thinking it would happen right away. After the first few unsuccessful months, I started to worry. I brought it up to Ava, and my mother, of all people. I told them my concerns before I even brought them up to Graham. My mother actually had the nerve to say that maybe God didn't think I was ready for a child yet. If God doesn't give babies to people who aren't ready for them, he's got a lot of explaining to do, because some of the mothers he chose to be fertile are very questionable, my own mother being one of them. Graham has been supportive throughout the entire ordeal, but sometimes I wonder if he gets as frustrated as I do with all the questions. They get harder to answer over and over. Sometimes when we're together and people ask why we haven't had children yet, Graham blames it on himself. I'm sterile, he'll say. He's far from sterile, though. He had his sperm count tested in the beginning, and it was fine. Actually, it was more than fine. The doctor used the word lavish. You have a lavish amount of sperm, Mr. Wells. Graham and I joked about that forever, but even though we tried to turn it into a joke, it meant the issue was all me. No matter how lavish his sperm count was, they weren't any good to my uterus. We had sex on a strict ovulation schedule. I took my temperature regularly. I ate and drank all the right foods. Still nothing. We pinched every penny we had, and tried IUI and then IVF, and were met with unsuccessful results. We've discussed surrogacy, but it's just as expensive as IVF, and according to our doctor, due to the endometriosis I was diagnosed with at 25, my eggs just aren't very reliable. Nothing has been successful, and we can't afford to keep repeating things we've already attempted, or even trying new techniques. I'm starting to realize it might never happen. This past year has been the absolute hardest of all the years. I'm losing faith, losing interest, losing hope. Losing, losing, losing. Are you interested in adoption? Eleanor asks. My eyes swing to hers, and I do my best to hide my exasperation. I open my mouth to answer her, but my mother leans in. Her husband isn't interested in adoption, she says. Mother, Ava hisses. She dismisses Ava with a flip of her hand. It's not like I'm telling the whole world. Eleanor and I are practically best friends. You haven't seen each other in almost a decade, I say. My mother squeezes Eleanor's hand. Well, it certainly doesn't feel like that long. How is Peter? Eleanor laughs, welcoming the change of subject as much as I do. She starts telling my mother about his new car and his midlife crisis, which technically can't be a midlife crisis because he's well into his 60s, but I don't correct them. I excuse myself and head to the restroom in an attempt to run away from the constant reminder of my infertility. I should have corrected her when my mother said Graham isn't interested in adoption. It's not that he's not interested. We just haven't had any luck in getting approved with an agency due to Graham's past. I don't understand how an adoption agency won't take into consideration that outside of that devastating conviction when he was a teenager, he's never so much as had a parking ticket. But when you're only one of thousands of couples applying to adopt, even one strike against you can rule you out. My mother is wrong. Neither of us is opposed to the idea, but we just can't get approved and we can no longer afford to keep trying. The treatments drained our bank account, and now that we have a second mortgage on our home, we wouldn't even know how to afford the process if we were approved. There are so many factors, and even though people think we haven't considered all of our options, we've considered them many times. Hell, Ava even bought us a fertility doll when she went to Mexico 3 years ago. But nothing, not even superstition, has worked in our favor. Graham and I decided early last year to leave it up to chance, hoping it will happen naturally. It hasn't. And to be honest, I'm tired of swimming upstream. The only thing holding me back from giving up completely is Graham. I know deep down if I let go of the dream of children, I will be letting go of Graham. I don't want to take the possibility of becoming a father away from him. I'm the infertile one, not Graham. Should he be punished by my infertility too? He says kids don't matter to him as much as I matter to him, but I know he says that because he doesn't want to hurt me. And because he still has hope. But 10 or 20 years from now, he'll resent me. He's human. I feel selfish when I have these thoughts. I feel selfish every time Graham and I have sex because I know I'm clinging to a hope that isn't there, dragging him along in a marriage that will eventually become too dull for either of us. Which is why I spend hours every day online searching for something that might give me an answer. Anything. I'm in support groups. I read all the message boards, the stories of miracle conceptions, the private adoption groups. I'm even in several parenting groups just in case I do eventually have a child. I'll be well prepared. The one thing I don't participate in online is social media. I deleted all my accounts last year. I just couldn't take the insensitive people on my timeline. April Fool's Day was the worst. I lost track of how many of my friends think it's funny to announce a fake pregnancy. They have absolutely no compassion for people in my situation. If they knew how many women have spent years dreaming of a positive result, they'd never even think to make light of it. And don't get me started on the number of my friends who complain about their children on their timeline. Evie was up all night crying, ugh, when will she sleep through the freaking night? Or, I can't wait for school to start back. These boys are driving me insane. If those mothers only knew. If I were a mother, I wouldn't take a single moment of my child's life for granted. I'd be grateful for every second they whined or cried or got sick or talked back to me. I'd cherish every second they were home during the summer, and I'd miss them every second they were away at school. That's why I deleted social media. Because with every status I saw, I became more and more bitter. I know those mothers love their children. I know they don't take them for granted. But they don't understand what it's like not to be able to experience the things that bring them stress. And rather than despise every person I'm friends with online, I decided to delete my accounts in hopes it would bring me a small semblance of peace. But it hasn't. Even without social media, not a single day goes by without being reminded that I might never be a mother. Every time I see a child, every time I see a pregnant woman, every time I run into people like Eleanor, almost every movie I watch, every book I read, every song I hear. And lately, every time my husband touches me. Chapter 5. Then. I've never brought a guy to my apartment who wasn't Ethan. In fact, Ethan rarely came here either. His apartment is nicer and much larger, so we always stayed there. But here I am, about to have rebound sex with a complete stranger just hours after I caught my fiancé having an affair. If Ethan is capable of an affair, I am certainly capable of revenge sex with an extremely attractive guy. This entire day has been one bizarre event after another. What's one more? I open the door and make a quick scan of the apartment, in case there's anything I need to hide. In doing so, I realize I'd have to hide everything, and that's not possible with Graham one step behind me. I step aside and allow him to enter my apartment. "Come in," I say. Graham walks in after me, taking in my apartment with his sad eyes. It's a small one-bedroom, but all the pictures of Ethan and me make it feel even smaller. Suffocating. Leftover wedding invitations are still spread out over the dining room table. The wedding dress I bought 2 weeks ago hangs from the entryway closet door. Seeing it makes me angry. I pull it down, fold the wedding bag over, and shove it in the closet. I don't even bother to hang it. I hope it gets wrinkled. Graham walks over to my bar and picks up a photo of Ethan and me. In the picture, Ethan had just proposed and I said yes. I was flashing my ring at the camera. I stand next to Graham and look at the photo with him. His thumb brushes over the glass.
"You look really happy here."
I don't respond because he's right. I look happy in that photo because I was happy. Extremely happy. And oblivious. How many times had Ethan cheated on me? Did it happen before he even proposed to me? I have so many questions, but I don't think I want the answers enough to eventually subject myself to an interrogation of Ethan. Graham sets the photo down on the bar, face down. And just like we did with our phones, he presses his finger against it and gives it a shove across the bar. It flies over the edge and shatters when it hits my kitchen floor. Such a careless, rude thing to do in someone else's apartment. But I like that he did it. There are two more pictures on the bar. I take the other one of Ethan and me and place it face down. I push it across the bar, and when that one shatters, I smile. So does Graham. We both stare at the last photo. Ethan isn't in this one. It's a picture of me and my father, taken just 2 weeks before he died. Graham picks it up and brings it in closer for inspection.
"Your dad?"
"Yeah." He sets the photo back on the counter. "This one can stay." Graham makes his way to the table where the leftover wedding invitations are laid out. I didn't choose the invitations. My mother and Ethan's mother did. They even mailed them out for us. My mother dropped these off 2 weeks ago and told me to look on Pinterest for crafts to make out of leftover invitations, but I had no desire to do anything with the invitations. I'll definitely be throwing them away now. I don't want a single keepsake from this disaster of a relationship. I follow Graham to the table, and I take a seat on it, pulling my legs up. I sit cross-legged as Graham picks up one of the invitations and begins reading it aloud.
"The honor of your presence is requested at the nuptials of Quinn Diane Whitley, daughter of Avril Donnelly, and the late Kevin Whitley of Old Greenwich, Connecticut, to Ethan Sampson Van Kemp, son of Dr. and Mrs. Sampson Van Kemp, also of Old Greenwich. The event will take place at the prestigious Douglas Wimberly Plaza on the evening of..."
Graham pauses reading and looks at me. He points at the wedding invitation.
"Your wedding invitation has the word prestigious in it."
I can feel the embarrassment in my cheeks. I hate those invitations. When I saw them for the first time, I threw a fit at the pretentiousness of the entire thing, but my mother and pretentious go hand in hand. My mother's doing. Sometimes it's easier to just let her get her way than put up a fight. Graham raises an eyebrow and then tosses the invitation back onto the pile.
"So, you're from Greenwich, huh?"
I can hear the judgment in his voice, but I don't blame him. Old Greenwich was recently rated one of the wealthiest cities in America. If you're a part of that wealth, it's commonplace to assume you're better than those who aren't. If you aren't part of that wealth, you judge those who are. It's a trend I refuse to be a part of.
You don't come across as a girl who hails from old Greenwich, he adds.
My mother would find that insulting, but his comment makes me smile. I take it as the compliment he meant it to be. And he's right. My microscopic apartment and the furnishings herein in no way resemble the home I grew up in. Thank you. I try very hard to separate myself from the dregs of high society.
You'd have to try even harder if you wanted to convince people you're a part of high society. And I mean that in a good way.
Another comment my mother would be insulted by. I'm starting to like this guy more and more. Are you hungry? I glance into the kitchen, wondering if I even have food to offer him. Luckily, he shakes his head.
Nah, I'm still kind of full from all the Chinese food and infidelity.
I laugh quietly. Yeah, me too. Graham scans my apartment once more, from my kitchen to the living room to the hallway that leads to the bedroom. Then his eyes land on me so hard I suck in a breath. He stares at me, then at my legs. I watch him as his eyes take in every part of me. It feels different, being looked at this way by someone who isn't Ethan. I'm surprised I like it. I wonder what Graham thinks when he looks at me. Is he just as shocked as me that he ended up here, in my apartment staring at me, rather than his own apartment standing by his own table staring at Sasha? Graham slips a hand inside his jacket pocket and pulls out a small box. He opens it and hands it to me. There's a ring inside of it, an obvious engagement ring, but it's significantly smaller than the one Ethan bought for me. I actually like this one better than mine. I wanted something a little subtler, but Ethan went with the most expensive one his father could afford.
I've been carrying it around for 2 weeks, Graham says.
He leans against the table next to me and stares down at the ring in my hand.
I haven't had the chance to propose because she kept blowing me off. I've been suspicious for a while now. She's such a good liar.
He says the last part of that sentence like he's impressed. I like it. I take the ring out of the box and slide it onto my right hand.
You can keep it. I don't need it anymore.
You should return it. It was probably expensive.
I got it off eBay. It's non-refundable.
I hold both hands out in front of me and compare the two rings. I look at my engagement ring and wonder why I never thought to tell Ethan beforehand that I didn't need something ostentatious. It's like I was so desperate to marry him, I lost my voice. My opinions. Me. I slide my engagement ring off my left hand and put it in the box, replacing the one that Graham bought Sasha. I hand the box to Graham, but he won't take it. Take it, I say, shoving it at him in an attempt to trade rings. He leans back on his hands so that I can't offer it to him.
That ring could buy you a new car, Quinn.
My car is paid for.
Then give the ring back to Ethan. He can give it to Sasha. She'd probably like it better than the one I bought for her.
He won't take the ring, so I place it on the table. I'll mail it to Ethan's mother. She can decide what to do with it. Graham stands up and shoves his hands in his jacket pockets. He really is better looking than Ethan. I wasn't saying that to flatter him earlier. Ethan's good looks derive mostly from confidence and money. He's always been well-groomed, well-dressed, and a little bit cocky. If a person believes they're good-looking enough, the rest of the world eventually believes it too. But Graham's attractiveness is more sincere. He doesn't have any spectacular features that stand out individually. His hair isn't a unique shade of brown. His eyes are dark, but they don't verge on black or unusual. If anything, the flat chestnut makes his eyes look even more sad than they would if his eyes were blue or green. His lips are smooth and full, but not in a way that would make me think about their distinctiveness if they weren't right in front of me. He's not extremely tall, to where his height would be something one would point out. He's probably right at 6 feet tall. His attractiveness comes from the combination of all the many pieces of him. His unspectacular features somehow come together to create this pull in my chest.
I love the way he looks at the world through a pair of calm eyes when his life is in complete turmoil. I'm completely drawn in by the way he smiles with only half of his mouth. When he speaks sometimes, he pauses and runs a thumb over his bottom lip. It's unintentionally sexy. I'm not sure I've ever been so physically attracted to someone I know so little. Graham looks at the front door, and I wonder if he changed his mind. Did I do something to turn him off? Is he still thinking about Sasha? He looks like he's about to call it a night. He pushes off the table, and I remain seated, waiting on him to give me all the reasons why this isn't a good idea. He moves his body so that he's standing directly in front of me. It's like he doesn't know what to do with his hands before he tells me goodbye, so he just shoves them in the pockets of his jeans. His gaze falls to my neck before traveling back up to my face. It's the first time his eyes have looked more intense than anything else.
Where's your bedroom?
I'm shocked by his forwardness. I try to hide my internal conflict because I would love more than anything to get back at Ethan by fucking his lover's hot boyfriend. But knowing that's also why Graham is here makes me wonder if I want to be someone else's revenge sex. It beats being alone right now. I slide off the table and stand up. Graham doesn't step back, so our bodies touch briefly before I move past him. I feel it everywhere, but mostly in my lungs. Follow me. I'm still nervous, but not nearly as nervous as when I was putting the key into the front door. Graham's voice calms me. His entire presence calms me. It's hard to be intimidated by someone so sad. I never make my bed, I admit as I open the door to my messy bedroom. I turn on a lamp, and Graham's frame fills the doorway.
Why not?
He takes a couple steps into my bedroom, and it's the strangest sight. This guy I don't know at all, standing in my bedroom. The same bedroom where I should be wallowing on my bed in broken-hearted anguish right now. And what about Graham? Does this feel just as strange to him? I know he's had doubts about Sasha, or he wouldn't have been following her to Ethan's apartment building with an engagement ring burning a hole in his pocket. Has Graham been looking for an out? Have I? Am I just now realizing it? Because right now, I'm nervous and anxious, and everything I shouldn't be just hours after my life took a turn for the worse. I'm staring wordlessly at Graham when I realize I haven't answered his question about why I don't make my bed. I clear my throat. It takes approximately 2 minutes to properly make a bed. That means the average person wastes an entire 38 days of their life making a bed they're just going to mess up. Graham looks amused. He gives me one of his half smiles and then glances at my bed. Watching him take in my bed makes me feel unprepared for this. I was prepared for a reunion with Ethan tonight, not for sex with a stranger. I don't know that I want the lights on. I don't even know that I want to be wearing what I'm wearing. I don't want Graham to have to take clothes off my body that were intended for another man. I need a moment to collect myself. I haven't had a moment yet, and I think I need one. I need to... I point toward the bathroom door. I need a minute. Graham's lips curl up into a slightly bigger smile, and I realize in this moment that those incredible lips are about to be touching mine, and I suddenly don't feel worthy. It's a weird feeling, because I am a confident woman. But Graham sets a standard for confidence that I'm not used to. His confidence makes mine feel like uncertainty. I shut myself in the bathroom and stare at the closed door. For a moment, I forget what I'm even doing in here. But then I remember I'm about to have sex with a guy who isn't Ethan, for the first time in 4 years. I kick it into high gear. I open my closet door and sift through it to find the most unassuming thing I can find. It's a blush-colored nightgown with spaghetti straps. It isn't see-through, but he'll be able to tell I'm not wearing the bra I'm currently ripping off. I pull the gown on and walk over to the bathroom sink. I pull my hair up into a loose bun to get it out of my face, and then I brush my teeth and my tongue, until I'm convinced my mouth won't remind him of the Chinese food we stole earlier. I check myself in the mirror and stare for a little too long. I just can't seem to wrap my mind around the fact that today is ending this way. Me, anticipating sex with a man who isn't my fiancé. I blow out a calming breath and then open my bathroom door. I'm not sure what I expected, but Graham looks the same. He's still standing in front of the bathroom door, still wearing his jeans and his t-shirt, and his jacket, and his shoes. I'm looking at his shoes when he whispers, "Wow." I look back up at him. He's closer. His face is so close to mine, and I really want to reach up and touch his jaw. I don't usually pay attention to a person's jaw, but his is strong and covered in stubble, leading all the way up to his mouth that looks as sad as his eyes. I think he notices our proximity because he immediately takes a step back and waves his hand toward my bed. My pillows are all lined up, and my duvet is tucked under the mattress and completely wrinkle-free. The corner of it is neatly folded over, revealing the sheet beneath it. "You made my bed?" I walk toward the bed and take a seat on it. This isn't how I envisioned this starting, but it's only because I've been stuck in an Ethan routine for the last 4 years. Graham lifts my duvet, and I pull my legs up and climb into my bed. I scoot over far enough for him to join me, but he doesn't. He just pulls the covers over me and sits down on the bed facing me.
"It's nice, huh?"
I adjust my pillow and roll over onto my side. He tucked the end of my blanket beneath the mattress so it doesn't give way. It feels snug and tight around my feet and legs. I actually kind of like it. And somehow even the top of the blanket seems to be snuggling me. I'm impressed. He reaches a hand to a loose strand of hair and tucks it behind my ear. The gesture is sweet. I don't know Graham very well at all, but I can tell he's good. I could tell he was good the second Ethan opened the door and Graham didn't physically attack him. It takes someone with a healthy amount of confidence and self-control to walk away quietly from a situation like that. Graham's hand comes to rest on my shoulder. I'm not sure what changed in him since we walked out of the bar or even since walking into my bedroom. But I can tell his thoughts are no longer where they were earlier. He slides his hand down the blanket, coming to rest on my hip. His entire expression seems rife with indecision. I try to ease the conflict a little.
"It's okay," I whisper. "You can go."
He sighs heavily with relief.
"I thought I could do this. Me and you, tonight?"
"I thought I could too, but it's way too soon for a rebound." I can feel the heat of his hand through the duvet. He moves it up a little and grips my waist as he leans forward. He kisses me softly on the cheek. I close my eyes and swallow hard, feeling his lips move to my ear.
"Even if it wasn't too soon, I still wouldn't want to be your rebound."
I feel him pull away.
"Good night, Quinn."
I keep my eyes closed as he lifts off the bed. I don't open them until he turns off my lamp and closes my bedroom door. He wouldn't want to be my rebound? Was that a compliment? Or was that him saying he's not interested? I mull over his parting words for a moment, but I soon shove them to the back of my mind. I'll think about Graham's words tomorrow. All I feel like thinking about in this moment is everything I've lost in the past few hours. My entire life changed today. Ethan was supposed to be my other half for the rest of my life. Everything I thought I knew about my future has been derailed. Everything I thought I knew about Ethan has been a lie. I hate him. I hate him because no matter what happens from this point forward, I will never be able to trust someone like I trusted him. I roll onto my back and stare up at my ceiling. "Fuck you, Ethan Van Kemp." What kind of last name is that anyway? I say my name out loud and add his last name to it. Quinn Diane Van Kemp. It's never sounded as stupid as it sounds right now. I'm relieved it will never be my name. I'm relieved I caught him cheating. I'm relieved I had Graham to walk me through it. I'm relieved Graham decided to leave just now. In that heated moment with Graham in the restaurant, I felt revengeful. I felt like sleeping with him would somehow ease the pain Ethan caused me today. But now that Graham has left, I realize nothing will cushion this feeling. It's just one huge, inconvenient, painful wound. I want to lock my front door and never leave my apartment. Except for ice cream. Tomorrow I'll leave for ice cream, but after that I'm never leaving my apartment again. Until I run out of ice cream. I toss the covers away and walk to the living room to lock the front door. When I reach up to the chain lock, I notice a yellow post-it stuck to the wall next to the door. There's a phone number on it. Beneath the phone number is a short message. Call me someday, after your rebound guy. Graham. I have a mixed reaction to his note. Graham seems nice, and I've already established my attraction to him, but at this point, I'm not sure I can stomach the thought of dating again. It's only been a couple of hours since my last relationship, and even if I got to a point where I felt like dating again, the last person I would want to date would be the ex-boyfriend of the girl who had a hand in ruining everything good in my life. I want as far from Ethan and Sasha as I can get, and sadly, Graham would only remind me of them. Even still, his note makes me smile, but only for a second. I go back to my room and crawl under my covers. I pull them over my head, and the tears begin to fall. Graham was right when he said, "You'll cry tonight, in bed. That's when it'll hurt the most, when you're alone." Chapter 6. Now. The day Ava left for Europe, she left me a gift. It was a bag of exotic tea that's supposed to help with infertility. The problem was, it tasted like I had ripped open a bag of tea and poured it straight on my tongue, then washed it down with coffee beans. So, the miracle fertility tea is out of the question. I'm leaving it up to chance again. I've decided I'll try for one more month, maybe two, before I tell Graham I'm finished trying. Two more months before I tell him I really am ready to open that wooden box on my bookshelf. I'm sitting on our kitchen counter in one of Graham's t-shirts when he walks through the door. My bare legs are dangling, feet pointing toward the floor. He doesn't immediately notice me, but once he does, I become his entire focus. I grip the counter between my legs, opening them just enough to let him in on my plans for the night. His eyes are locked on my hands as he pulls at his tie, sliding it from his collar, dropping it to the floor. That's one of my favorite things about him working later than me. I get to watch him take his tie off every day.
"Special occasion?"
He grins as he takes me in with one fell swoop. He's walking toward me and I give him my best seductive smile. The one that says I want to put all the pretending behind us for the night. Pretending we're okay, pretending we're happy, pretending this is exactly the life we'd choose if the choice were ours. By the time he reaches me, his jacket is off and the first few buttons of his shirt are undone. He slips off his shoes at the same time his hands slide up my thighs. I wrap my arms around his neck, and he presses against me, ready and eager. His lips meet my neck, and then my jaw, and then he presses them gently against my mouth.
"Where would you like me to take you?"
He picks me up and secures me against him as I lock my legs around his waist. I whisper in his ear, "Our bedroom sounds nice." Even though I've all but given up on the chances of becoming pregnant, I'm obviously still clinging to that small sliver of hope on at least a monthly basis. I don't know if that makes me strong or pathetic. Sometimes I feel I'm both. Graham drops me on the bed, our clothes covering the distance from the kitchen to our room like scattered breadcrumbs. He settles himself between my legs and then pushes inside me with a groan. I take him in with silence. Graham is consistent in every possible way outside of the bedroom. But inside the bedroom, I never know what I'm going to get. Sometimes, he makes love to me with patience and selflessness, but sometimes he's needy and quick and selfish. Sometimes he's talkative while he's inside me, whispering words that make me fall even more in love with him. But sometimes he's angry and loud, and says things that make me blush. I never know what I'm going to get with him. That used to excite me. But now, I tend to want only one of the many sides of him in the bedroom, the needy, quick, and selfish side of him. I feel less guilt when I get this side of him, because lately the only thing I really want out of sex is the end result. Sadly, tonight is not the selfish version of Graham in the bedroom. Tonight, he's the exact opposite of what I need from him right now. He's savoring every second of it, pushing into me with controlled thrusts, while he tastes all the parts of my neck and upper body. I try to be as involved as he is, occasionally pressing my lips to his shoulders or pulling at his hair. But it's hard to pretend I don't want him to get it over with. I turn my head to the side so he can leave his mark on my neck while I wait. He eventually begins to pick up the pace, and I tense a little, anticipating the end, but he pulls out of me unexpectedly. He's lowering himself down my body, drawing my left nipple into his mouth when I recognize this pattern. He's going to make his way down, slowly tasting every part of me, until he eventually slides his tongue between my legs, where he'll waste a precious 10 minutes, and I'll have to think too much about what day it is, what time it is, what 14 days from now will be, what I would do or say if the test is finally positive, how long I'll cry in the shower if it's negative again. I don't want to think tonight. I just want him to hurry. I pull his shoulders until his mouth is back near mine, and I whisper in his ear, "It's okay. You can finish." I try to guide him back inside of me, but he pulls back. I make eye contact with him for the first time since we were in the kitchen. He brushes my hair back gently.
"Are you not in the mood anymore?"
I don't know how to tell him I was never in the mood to begin with without hurting his feelings. "It's fine. I'm ovulating." I try to kiss him, but before my lips meet his, he rolls off me. I stare at the ceiling, wondering how he can possibly be upset with me for that comment. We've been trying to get pregnant for so long now. This routine is nothing new. I feel him leave the bed. When I look at him, his back is to me and he's pulling on his pants. "Are you seriously mad because I'm not in the mood?" I ask, sitting up. "If you don't recall, we were just having sex less than a minute ago, regardless of my mood." He spins around and faces me, taking a pause to gather his thoughts. He pulls a frustrated hand through his hair and then steps closer to the bed. The clench of his jaw reveals his irritation, but his voice is quiet and calm when he speaks.
"I'm tired of fucking for the sake of science, Quinn. It would be nice if just one time I could be inside you because you want me there, not because it's a requirement to getting pregnant."
His words sting. Part of me wants to lash out and say something hurtful in return, but most of me knows he's only saying it because it's true. Sometimes I miss the spontaneous lovemaking too, but it got to a point where all our failed attempts at getting pregnant began to hurt too much. So much that I realized the less sex we had, the less disappointment I would feel. If we only had sex during the days I was ovulating, I would be disappointed a fewer number of times. I wish he could understand that. I wish he knew that sometimes the trying is harder for me than the failing. I try to empathize with his feelings, but it's hard because I don't know that he truly empathizes with mine. How could he? He's not the one failing every time. I can be disappointed in myself later. Right now, I just need him back on this bed. Back inside me. Because he's right. Sex with my husband is definitely a requirement to getting pregnant. And today is our best chance this month. I kick the covers off me so that I'm sprawled out on the bed. I press one of my hands against my stomach and pull his attention there. "I'm sorry," I whisper, trailing my fingers upward. "Come back to bed, Graham." His jaw is still clenched, but his eyes are following my hand. I watch his struggle as part of him wants to storm out of the room and part of him wants to storm me. I don't like that he's not convinced I want him yet, so I roll over onto my stomach. If there's one thing about me physically that Graham loves the most, it's the view of me from behind. "I want you inside me, Graham. That's all I want. I promise." I lie. I'm relieved when he groans.
"Damn it, Quinn."
And then he's on the bed again, his hands on my thighs, his lips against my ass. He slips one hand beneath me, and presses it flat against my stomach, lifting me enough so that he can easily slide into me from behind. I moan and grasp the sheets convincingly. Graham grips my hips and lifts himself up onto his knees, pulling me back until he's all the way inside me. I no longer have the patient Graham. He's a mixture of emotions right now, thrusting into me with impatience and anger. He's focused on finishing and not at all focused on me, and that's exactly how I want it. I moan and meet his thrusts, hoping he doesn't recognize that the rest of me is disconnected to this moment. After a while, we somehow move from both being on our knees to me being pressed stomach first into the mattress as all his weight bears down on me. He grips my hands that are gripping the sheets, and I relax as he releases a groan. I wait for him to fill me with hope. But he doesn't. Instead, he pulls out of me, pressing himself against the small of my back. Then he groans one final time against my neck. I feel it meet my skin, warm and wet as it slides down my hips and seeps into the mattress. Did he just... He did. Tears sting at my eyes when I realize he didn't finish inside me. I want to climb out from under him, but he's too heavy, and he's still tense, and I can't move. As soon as I feel him begin to relax, I attempt to lift up. He rolls over onto his back. I roll away from him, using the sheet beneath me to wipe myself clean. Tears are streaming down my cheeks, and I swipe at them angrily. I am so angry I can't even speak. Graham just watches me as I try to conceal the anger I'm feeling, and the embarrassment. Graham is my husband, but tonight he was a means to an end, and even though I tried to convince him otherwise, he just proved that to himself by not giving me the only thing I wanted from him tonight. I can't stop the tears from falling, but I try anyway. I pull the blanket up to my eyes, and Graham rolls off the bed and grabs his pants. My quiet tears begin to turn to sobs, and my shoulders begin to shake. It's not like me to do this in front of him. I usually save this for my long showers. As Graham grabs his pillow off the bed, part of him looks like he wants to console me, while the other part looks like he wants to scream at me. The angry part wins out, and he begins to walk toward the door. "Graham," I whisper. My voice stops him in his tracks, and he turns around and faces me. He seems so heartbroken, I don't even know what to say. I wish I could say I'm sorry for wanting a baby more than I want him, but that wouldn't help, because it would be a lie. I'm not sorry. I'm bitter that he doesn't understand what sex has become to me over the last few years. He wants me to continue to want him, but I can't when sex and making love have always given me hope that it might be that one in a million chance I'll get pregnant. And all the sex and lovemaking that leads to the hope then leads to the moment all that hope is overcome by devastation. Over the years, the entire routine and the emotions it brings started running together. I couldn't separate the sex from the hope, and I couldn't separate the hope from the devastation. Sex became hope, became devastation. Sex, hope, devastation. 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 Now it all feels devastating to me. He'll never understand that. He'll never understand that it isn't him I don't want, it's the devastation. Graham watches me, waiting for me to follow his name up with something else. But I don't. I can't. He nods a little, turning away from me. I watch the muscles in his back tense. I watch his fist clench and unclench. I can see him release a heavy sigh even though I can't hear it. And then he opens the bedroom door with ease before slamming it shut with all his strength. A loud thud hits the door from the other side. I squeeze my eyes shut, and my whole body tenses as it happens again. And then again. I listen as he punches the door 5 times from the other side. I listen as he releases his hurt and rejection against the wood because he knows there's nowhere else it can go. When everything is silent again, I shatter. Chapter 7. Then. It's been difficult getting over Ethan. Well, not Ethan, per se. Losing the relationship was harder than losing Ethan. When you associate yourself with another person for so long, it's difficult becoming your own person again. It took a few months before I finally deleted him from my apartment completely. I got rid of the wedding dress, the pictures, the gifts he'd given me over the years, clothes that reminded me of him. I even got a new bed, but that probably had more to do with just wanting a new bed than being reminded of Ethan. It's been 6 months now, and the only reason I'm on my second date with this Jason guy is because the first one wasn't a complete disaster. And Ava talked me into it. As much as my mother loved Ethan and still wishes I'd forgive him, I think she would like Jason even more. That should probably be a positive, but it isn't. My mother and I have very different tastes. I'm waiting for Jason to say or do something that my mother would hate so that I can be drawn to him a little more than I am. He's already repeated several questions he asked me last Friday. He asked how old I was. I told him I was 25, the same age I was last Friday. He asked when my birthday was, and I told him it was still July 26th. I'm trying not to be a bitch, but he makes it difficult when it's clear he didn't pay attention to a single thing I said last week.
So, you're a Leo, he asks.
I nod.
I'm a Scorpio.
I have no idea what that says about him. Astrology has never been my thing. Besides, it's hard to pay attention to Jason because there's something much more interesting behind him. Two tables away, smirking in my direction, is Graham. As soon as I recognize him, I immediately look down at my plate. Jason says something about the compatibility of Scorpios and Leos, and I look him in the eyes, hoping he can't see the chaos I'm feeling right now. But my resolve is broken because Graham is standing now. I can't help but look over Jason's shoulder and watch as Graham excuses himself from his table. He locks eyes with me again and begins to head in our direction. I'm squeezing the napkin in my lap, wondering why I'm suddenly more nervous at the sight of Graham than I've ever been around Jason. I make eye contact with Graham right before he approaches the table, but as soon as I look at him, he looks away. He nods his head once in the direction he's walking. He passes our table, his hand just barely touching my elbow. A 1 second graze of his finger across my skin. I suck in air.
How many siblings do you have?
I lay my napkin on the table. Still just the one. I push my chair back. I'll be right back. I need to use the restroom. Jason scoots back, half standing as I push my chair in. I smile at him and turn toward the restrooms. Toward Graham. Why am I so nervous? The bathrooms are at the rear of the restaurant. You have to make a turn behind a partition to find the hallway. Graham has already disappeared around the corner, so I pause before I make the turn. I put my hand on my chest, hoping it will somehow calm what's happening inside of it. And then I blow out a quick breath and walk into the hallway. Graham is leaning casually against a wall, his hand in the pocket of his suit. The sight of him both excites me and comforts me, but I'm also nervous because I feel bad for never calling him. Graham smiles his lazy half-smile at me.
Hello, Quinn.
His eyes still frown a little with his smile, and I'm happy to see that. I don't know why. I like that he always looks to be battling some inner perpetual turmoil. Hey. I stand awkwardly a few feet away from him.
Graham, he says, touching his chest. In case you forgot.
I shake my head. I didn't. It's kind of hard to forget every detail of the worst day of your life. My comment makes him smile. He pushes off the wall and takes a step closer to me.
You never called.
I shrug, like I haven't given his phone number much thought. But in reality, I look at it every day. It's still stuck to the wall where he left it. You said to call you after my rebound guy. I'm just now getting around to the rebound guy.
Is that who you're with tonight?
I nod. He takes a step closer, leaving only 2 feet between us. But it feels like he's suffocating me. What about you? I ask. Are you with your rebound girl?
My rebound was 2 girls ago.
I hate that answer. I hate it enough to be done with this conversation. Well, congratulations. She's pretty.
Graham narrows his eyes as if he's trying to read all the things I'm not saying. I take a step toward the women's restroom and put my hand on the door.
It was good to see you, Graham.
His eyes are still narrowed, and he tilts his head a little. I'm not sure what else to say. I walk into the women's restroom and allow the door to swing shut behind me. I let out a huge sigh. That was intense.
Why was that so intense?
I walk over to the sink and turn on the water. My hands are shaking, so I wash them in warm water, hoping the lavender soap helps calm my nerves. I dry them and then look at them in the mirror, trying to convince myself I wasn't that affected by Graham. But I was. They're still shaking. For 6 months, I've wanted to call him, but for 6 months, I've talked myself out of it. And now, knowing he's moved on and he's with someone else, I might have blown my chance. Not that I wanted one. I still hold fast to the belief that he would remind me too much of what happened. If I do decide to start something up with someone, I want it to be someone brand new. Someone completely unrelated to the worst days of my life. Someone like Jason, maybe?
Jason, I whisper. I should get back to my date.
When I open the door, Graham is still in the same spot, still looking at me with his head tilted. I stop short, and the door hits me in the back when it swings shut, pushing me forward a step. I glance toward the end of the hallway and then look back at Graham.
Were we not finished?
He inhales a slow breath as he takes a step toward me. He stops only a foot from me this time, sliding both hands back into his pockets.
How are you?
His voice is quiet, like it's hard for him to get it out. The way his eyes are searching mine makes it obvious he's referring to everything I've been through with the breakup, calling off the wedding. I like the sincerity in his question. I'm feeling all the same comfort his presence brought me that night 6 months ago.
Good, I say, nodding a little.
A few residual trust issues, but other than that, I can't complain.
He looks relieved.
Good.
What about you?
He stares at me a moment, but I don't see what I'm hoping to see in his eyes. Instead, I see regret, sadness, like maybe he still hasn't recovered from losing Sasha. He shrugs, but doesn't answer with words. I try not to let my pity show, but I think it does.
Maybe this new girl will be better than Sasha, and you'll finally be able to get over her.
Graham laughs a little. I'm over Sasha, he says with conviction. Pretty sure I was over Sasha the moment I met you. He gives me absolutely zero time to absorb his words before he throws more of them at me. We better get back to our dates, Quinn. He turns and walks out of the hallway. I stand still, dumbfounded by his words. Pretty sure I was over Sasha the moment I met you.
I can't believe he just said that to me. He can't say something like that and then just walk away.
I stalk after him, but he's already halfway to his table. I catch Jason's eye, and he smiles when he sees me, standing up. I try to compose myself, but it's hard as I watch Graham lean down and give his date a quick kiss on the side of her head before he takes his seat across from her again. Is he trying to make me jealous? If he is, it's not working. I don't have time for frustrating men. I barely have time for boring men like Jason. Jason has walked around the table to pull out my chair for me. Before I take my seat, Graham makes eye contact with me again. I swear I can see him smirk a little. I don't know why I stoop to his level, but I lean over and give Jason a quick kiss on the mouth. Then I sit. I have a clear shot of Graham as Jason walks back around to his side of the table. Graham is no longer smirking. But I am. I'm ready to get out of here, I say.
Chapter 8. Now.
Ava and I talked on the phone almost every day when she lived in Connecticut, but now that she's halfway across the world, we seem to talk even more. Sometimes twice a day, even with the time difference.
I have to tell you something.
There's a trepidation in her voice. I close my front door and walk my things to the kitchen counter. Are you okay? I set down my purse, pull the phone from between my shoulder and ear, and grip the phone in my hand. Yes, she says.